up for heroin, for processed heroin in Southeast Asia with the arrival of 500,000 American troops. So responding to those two facts, what's happened is that much more of the opium grown in Southeast Asia is now being processed there on the scene into heroin. Some of the people that we know are involved in this are General Juan Ratikun, who until recently was the chief of the Royal Lao Army, the puppet army in Laos. He has boasted directly to Al McCoy, a graduate student at Yale. Ratikun boasted directly to him that he's been the biggest entrepreneur in the dope business since 1962. In the last few years, he's opened his own laboratories in Laos to process the opium down into heroin. Also, Vang Pao, a Mayo tribesman who's the commander of the mercenary army, the Mayo mercenary army that's financed and led by CIA operatives that you must know, is another important entrepreneur. One of the ways that he keeps getting recruits from the Mayo tribesmen is that he offers them a market for their opium production, and then he himself owns a laboratory. It was located in Longcheng, the recently secret CIA base in Laos, since that area has been more or less surrounded and besieged by the Pathet Lao and the NVA. Now, it's not clear where the lab has gone, probably perhaps into Burma from what I can tell. But in any case, he too, one of the main leaders of the mercenary armies that the United States counts on in Southeast Asia, he too is a big entrepreneur. And these people, there's another guy in Vientiane in Laos, an overseas Chinese racketeer named Hu Tim Heng. He, interestingly enough, is the co-owner of the Pepsi-Cola bottling company of Vientiane. And he used that position as a cover for bringing in chemicals that were necessary to the refining of the opium down to heroin, particularly a chemical called acetic anhydride. He on the customs declarations and so on, reported this as necessary for the production of Pepsi-Cola. In fact, it's used in his lab for the refining of the opium into heroin. Largely due to the efforts of these guys that you found a very sudden, sharp increase in the presence of heroin, refined heroin, in Vietnam and among the American GIs in the late 60s, 68, 69, depending on the area. You guys probably can testify, other people who've been there, in the early years of the American war there, there was plenty of grass, some black opium, various other drugs, and some heroin, but not all that much. But there was a pretty sharp increase around 68, 69. Fred Branfman, whom many of you may have heard of as a guy who's done a lot of investigation into the air war, reports that where he was in Laos in the spring of 1969, very abruptly, heroin appeared every place in vials, little vials that had the same markings, the same brand markings on all of them. That evidently is due to the discovery of some of these Laotian generals that instead of just selling and passing on their opium through Air America and other ways, that they could make a healthy profit by processing it on the scene and selling it to the American army. Whether or not there's some speculation, as far as I know, no way to document it, about the approval of the certain American generals and intelligence people of this, and because this happened at a time when, as you know, discipline in the military is breaking down, mutiny seemed to be around the corner in many units and took place in many units. So it may well be that some Americans knew about this production of heroin in Southeast Asia and approved of it. Certainly, it was no secret that these labs existed. People on the scene have known about them for years, and if the Americans had really wanted to cut off the trade, it would have been easy enough, and still is.
My name's Rene Hernandez. I served in the Army from 1966 to 1967. I went in September of 1966. At that time, I had an alternative of either going into the armed forces or facing 3 years in prison for two cases that I had, criminal cases I had pending here in New York City. I chose what I thought was the lesser of the two evils, the Army. Then again, I had been using drugs. I was strung out at the time, and I felt that perhaps I could get away from it all, even if it was through the Army. No sooner had I gotten to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, I was already high on marijuana. No sooner had I gotten my first pass to the town there, I was getting high on heroin. Later on, I was sent to Fort Gordon, Georgia. The same thing happened there. No sooner had I gotten there, I was getting high again. Finally, I was sent to Vietnam. The first day I got there, I was high on a reefer. There wasn't too much heroin at that time out there. I was sent to be attached to a combat engineer brigade. I had a supply MOS, and I went to do supply work there. No sooner had I been sent to this company, I discovered drugs were on the scene too. There was mostly reefer and opium, liquid tar opium. And I began to wonder, you know, like the tar opium came in little vials and, you know, it was hooked up, you know, in a real sophisticated manner, you know, and like kind of, you know, made me think, you know, that the same things that exist here exist over there. They have their mafia, they have their, you know, and if they have their mafia, quite naturally, they're being protected by the politicians or by somebody who should be putting a stop to this.
E.B. Del Rosario.
29 years old. Served in the Marine Corps from October 1961. To February 1966, I was Lance Corporal. My testimony concerns not what I did in the military, but what I did as a civilian from 1967 to 1968 in Laos. I was operations assistant for Continental Air Services, the least known of the two airlines that operate out of Laos under contract by the CIA. The other one, of course, is Air America. As an operations assistant for Continental Air Services, I had to monitor all the flights that were going in and out of Laos. I had to know what cargo was aboard. I had to know where the cargo was going, how the cargo was to be handled. And this was, like I said, in 1967, 68. A lot of their flights were for USAID. It was for resupply of the Mayo tribesmen and Yao tribesmen in the hills of Laos, dropping rice, wheat, cornmeal, and so forth. But there's a small amount of trade which very few people knew about until just recently, and that trade was opium. And it was being flown on US planes. It was being flown by U.S. pilots, and eventually being used by U.S. troops in Vietnam.
My name is Sylvan Oliveri. I'm from the DMZ. I went to the Marine Corps in 1968. And my reason for going was, like, I wanted to finish school. Like, I was doing good in school, and the schools went on strike. And, like, I wanted to, you know, further my education. And, like, the education program that, you know, the recruiter ran down to me was beautiful. Like, I could go to college. You know, I could do just about anything. And, like, that's what I wanted to do. What wound up was that I went to boot camp, went to Camp Lejeune, wound up staying there for 13 months. You know, no school, no time for school. And later on, I wound up going to headquarters Marine Corps. Then I wound up going to Vietnam and, at the end of 70. Like, it was unreal. Like, I got into Da Nang, and they brought me around and says, "Hey, this is your hooch." And this sergeant brought me there, you know, met everybody. He says, "Well, we're gonna make you, you know, feel at home." They brought me my rifle, you know, some sheets, a pack, and a cap of dope, you know. And I was all set. And that was it, you know, like, it was like outrageous. Like, you wake up in the morning and somebody just, you know, like, serve you dope. Like, before I went to Vietnam, like, I really, like, I wasn't into anything. Like, I didn't know what it was. And, like, I found out real quick.
Okay.
Del Rosario.
I'll give you a rundown on how, my part in it. I would get a call on a field phone, and I'd pick it up, and on the other end, a person I've never seen called the customer. I'd pick it up and I'd say, Lima Continental, which is our code name for our base in Vientiane, Laos. And he would say, "This is a customer. I have special cargo coming in on such and such a flight. I want special handling for it."
WBAI New York.
What I would do, the customer is known, is a CIA. We speak about him only as a customer, not as the agency or the CIA or anything else. Special cargo is opium. So I would make sure that there would be a special crew out there to meet that aircraft, to make sure nobody tampers with that aircraft, and that a special area would be set aside for that aircraft or for the cargo. It would either be taken from the ramp at Continental Air Services onto special trucks and hauled away to a storage point somewhere in Vientiane, or it would be taken over to the Air America ramp and later on flown from Vientiane to Pak Sei, which is south, or Savannakhet, which is south, or to Udorn, which is the south. All this cargo was coming in from Lima 25, Ban Hue Sai. Lima 25 is the code name for Ban Hue Sai. It'd be flown in from Ban Hue Sai into Long Chen, which is up until recently was a secret base of the CIA. It would be and at Long Chen there were two refineries, opium refineries that will refine it into heroin. From there it would go into the base where I was at in Vientiane, from there down south.
My name is Bob Rodriguez. I'm 23 years old, and I'm currently at the DMZ, which stands for Drug Mending Zone. And I went into service in July of 1967, and I went there trying to get away from drugs. But wow, man, from day one, I was getting high in reception center. And like, it seemed like all my time going through basic and AIT, the only hassle that I was really going through is whether I wanted to speed this day or nod it out, you know? So I went through basic, went through radio operator school, and they thought I was involved with drugs there, so they said that I'm not capable of being a radio operator, so they shipped, after I got out of radio operator school, they sent me to be a supply clerk. After I got out of there, I went home for 30 days, and I kept on shooting drugs and shit. And when I got back to my company area, after my supply that I had brought back with me diminished, I cracked on my CO. I says, wow, I need help. Can you help me kick or whatever? And he came out with that same old army thing, you know. If the army wanted you to have a dope habit, they would have gave you one, you know. So I booked, came back to the city, went AWOL. I was AWOL for quite a while. The feds picked me up and they took me to Fort Dick Stockade. And like when I got over there, they seen my tracks and they see that I was going through changes, you know, so they threw me in segregation and gave me those all-purpose capsules to kick, you know. And I was a hell of a change, man. Like, I was sick and all that, so I done quite a bit of time there, and they sent me to Fort Riley, Kansas, CTF, Correctional Training Facilities. I was in the 7th unit, and while I was there, they had started a supposedly a drug education program, and what it really was, it was a mass meeting of all the heads of the army and all that, because everybody there was there because they were in the stockades, and they were supposed to have gone there to redo basic all over again. So all the heads from California, New York, whatever, got together. And all we really did was rap about who's got what and what unit, you know? So after that meeting, all we do is go to the certain unit and cop what we wanted. And like the instructors there, like they really didn't know anything about drugs. All they were telling us is what they were reading from a book, you know? And it didn't make no kind of sense. So after that, like, I got orders to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and I went over there, and it was dope there, too. So I got high, kept getting high, went AWOL again, came home, and then I got put back into Fort Dick Stockade. And I was there for quite some time, and it's funny, man, because while I was there, I came out with a bigger Jones than when I went in.
Also in 1966, I was helping a friend of mine.
Del Rosario.
A Britisher. We were studying the language of the Mayo and the Yao. Rather, he was, and I was up there because I was an adventurer. And we had come across several opium fields, and we had seen them in the process of cultivation. We had seen some fields where the poppy was just being cut. We had seen the collection of the opium rolled up into balls, prepared for shipment. We accompanied the convoy, the mule convoy, down the hills from Ban Hui Sai into smaller towns in Nan province, northern Thailand, and into Chiang Rai province, northern Thailand also. I was also in Ban Hui Sai, where I saw convoys coming in, mule convoys loaded with opium. I saw the storage points in Ban Hui Sai. And you may ask where all the connection is. The only way you can get things out of Ban Hui Sai, which is in the Golden Triangle, is by air. The Mekong River runs through it, but it's entirely too dangerous. Many parts of it are uncontrolled by, are not under the control of the United States government or the United States paid forces of Laos. And so they would have to fly it out of there. And about two flights a week fly out of there that are mostly loaded with opium. And now the only thing that's grown around the Ban Hui Sai area are chili peppers. And there's no market for chili peppers in Vientiane. And when it's manifested on board the aircraft, it's labeled miscellaneous, or sometimes spare parts. And so you can check all you want, but you'll find a lot of miscellaneous and a lot of spare parts flying out of Ban Hui Sai.
Sam Stone was alone when he popped his last balloon, climbing walls while sitting in a chair. Well, he played his last request while the room smelled just like death.
Gittins. I'm 23 years old. I went into the service on March 10, 1969. I got to Benoit on October 2nd, 1969. October 7th, I had orders to go with a signal unit. They sent me instead to the 9th Infantry Division stationed at Canto. I had no infantry training at the time, you know. They gave me a supposedly two-week infantry training course, you know, which really, to me, wasn't too hip. But, like, you know, I went along with it because I was trying to, you know, make the best out of the service. While I was with the 9th Infantry Division, you know, I got hooked up. I was going out in the bush every day. And, like, you know, it started getting to me, man. So I started getting high in order, you know, to deal with it. Like everybody else was getting high before they went out in the bush. So, you know, I started doing it too. Then after being with them for about a month, you know, I just got disgusted. I said, well, like, you know, I ain't doing this no more. When this happened, they sent me to LBJ or Silver City. You know, I call it Silver City because, like, it's a little city, you know, a drug city. I got in there, and, like, all I did was continue shooting dope, dropping pills, smoking, getting high every day. I stayed in LBJ for about 20, 25 days, and they stationed me on Long Bend with a signal company this time. This signal company was composed mostly of brothers and Puerto Ricans that were, you know, formerly in the stockade, you know. And, like, what was happening in this company was everybody was getting high, you know. So I just felt, continued getting high. We did this, you know, every day, man. Like, the officers knew what was going on. Like, you know, they could, I mean, you know, it was apparent that, you know, we was high because we wasn't normal. Nobody was working. There were no job functions. Nobody was doing nothing but getting high. They sent me to Bangkok, Thailand. Like, you know, I went ahead and I went to Bangkok. And, like, when I got to Bangkok, you know, I met some brothers that I had known before over there. And, like, you know, they took me to the drugstore. And there it was, more dope. Pills, anything I wanted at a price, like Seconals, one for a nickel, Dexedrine, one for a nickel, Methadrine, 15 cents, you know, Robitussin, $1.50 a bottle, so just continued getting high. So, like, when I got there, I was supposed to report to my unit, but I didn't. I went AWOL, you know, stayed AWOL for about 3-4 months, you know. While I was AWOL, I was getting high, and, you know, I started committing crimes to get money, like writing checks, taking off government properties, a whole lot of things, you know. I got busted in Thailand, and they sent me to Okinawa Stockade, JSS. I got to Okinawa, I stayed there for about, when I first got to Okinawa, like, I went, you know, they was rapping to me about, you know, stockade procedures and all this other bullshit, and I told the sergeant that was in charge that, you know, I was sick, I needed some medication. He told me, he said, that's your fucking problem. And they put me inside the box. You know, I stayed in the box my entire time in Okinawa. But, like, the fact that I was in the box, which was supposed to be a maximum security, didn't stop me from getting high. Because the guards, they had dope, they was getting high. So, like, I'd get down with them. Or, like, at the time, I had a problem with my feet. I'd go to visit the medic in the stockade. And, like, you know, every time I went there, we shot some opium. Like, finally, they sent me back to Thailand to my unit. They, started writing up court-martial papers on me. You know, I was facing the general court-martials for about, like, I had about 23 charges. I don't even remember what they was. You know, I wasn't really interested. Like, in the time that I was there, like, all I, you know, people there was getting high, so I started getting high. I was getting high. That's all I was doing, man. Like, you know, the CO would call me in the morning, let's say about 8 o'clock, I'd go up in his office, and I'd be high, you know, fucked up, and you sit outside and wait for me. Like, I'd be so high, I'd pass out, you know. by the time he got ready to see me, he just tells somebody, yeah, take him back to his bunk, you know. And like, never once did anybody ask me, well, like, you know, would you like to do something about this drug problem, or are we gonna put you in a program? I knew nothing about an amnesty program or nothing like that.
My name's Issa Abed. I was a psychotherapist in the military, U.S. Air Force, February 68 to February 72. And I ran the amnesty program at Travis Air Force Base, California, for a year, and then I was transferred to U.S. Air Force Hospital, England, where I stayed for about 3 years and ran a program. I believe the Army instituted the program, amnesty, to sort of deal with the problem, or try to deal with the problem of drug addiction in the military, which was very much of a problem, but played down by the military. What this amnesty program entailed was nothing more than a token effort to appease the public, which was clamoring for some sort of treatment for GIs. And what it was is a dude would sign up for a treatment, would give a legal power to the CO, his CO or the psychiatrist whom he saw, to legally entangle him in all sorts of entrapments. And I don't think there was any medical or psychological aid given usually in the Army. I can testify to the fact that the Air Force program, which was known as the Limited Privilege Communications Program, was a total failure. As a matter of fact, I discouraged all people who came in applying for drug treatment or drug use, admitting to the fact that they were addicts or heavy users of any number of drugs, from signing up. Guys were actually getting discharged on punitive measures, administrative discharges, for being addicts or for turning themselves in, just even for smoking marijuana. Or they were getting jail sentences, they were getting OSI pressure, which is the Office of Special Investigations, pressure to testify, rat, or give information. So, and as a matter of fact, for the last 5 months that I was in the service, not one guy signed up for the program.
Lewis Samuels.
I was in the Army in 69, I came out in 71 with a BCD after doing 16 months in a day in Fort Monmouth and Fort Dix Stockade. I was supposed to go to Leavenworth Penitentiary, but somehow I never did get to go. They had just started the amnesty program there, Fort Dix. This is in Fort Dix, New Jersey. They had just started the amnesty program, and I was one of the first members. You know, I helped build up the joint. They didn't know about my drug problem. They knew I was in the stockade all the time. They knew that my charges was related to drugs for me going into the stockade and so forth. So they asked me to come and volunteer my time and services. And I went for it because I didn't have to pull KP or I didn't have no other duty. That was like my duty, you know. So I said, boss, I go for that. And what it got into, like, before I knew it, they didn't ask me. They just told me, like, I'm going to serve with these people. You know, this is going to be my job for the rest of the time in the service. And that they indoctrinated me, and they wanted me in turn to indoctrinate people coming to ask for help. You know, cats coming in saying, I want help, or I want to see a psychiatrist or whatever. You know, they wanted me to indoctrinate them. Only thing that they was offering, no medication whatsoever, nothing. I mean, if a cat threw up in somebody's face, they might take them to the hospital, you know, but other than that, they give you nothing, you know. Only thing they offered was friendship, you know, like, I'll be your friend. But if a cat's showing up sick, he don't want a friend, you know, unless you got a dollar to give him. You ain't got a dollar to give him, he don't need you, you know. And this is all this place had to offer. And, like, I tell you, I've seen cats coming there with reefer habits, you know, or, you know, what was a problem to them. I mean, okay, if that's, you know, I can dig that. It was a problem to them. And they came in there, you know, just smoking reefers, and they never even seen or heard of, you know, dope other than in the newspaper. And yet these cats now, they banging up there right now, you know, sticking needles in there on heroin. Like, you got cats in there, like he said, you know, I went in with a chippy. I might have thought I had a habit, but it wasn't really nothing to tell, you know, but when I came out, I had a gorilla on my back, you know, and I know there's plenty of other cats in there, you know, same thing. And only reason, another reason why a lot of people come in there, they offer you amnesty, whereas if you take a bus, a fall, or a narcotic bus, or anything you did previously, as long as your company commander or your brigade commander is willing to drop it, you know, you can get down with this. So it's really nothing more than a joke. That's all it really is. It was a joke. They had what they call CID, Central Intelligence Division. They used to, they had a man, you know, in there that was part of this program. You know, he used to, like, get next to people and try and get up different type of information or, you know, whatever he was there for, whatever his purpose was. And I know them cats tried to bust me, and they, you know, they was on me for a long time. I was up there, like, from the time I went back up until the time I got discharged, and I was...